Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Thriving Adoptees podcast. So today I'm delighted to be joined by Isaac, and you are in for an empowering treat here. This guy has got a voice like syrup, or maple syrup, a voice like it's just beautiful. It's so resonant. It's so deep. And he is coming from his heart. All the way from the USA today. So Isaac, welcome to the show, buddy. I'm really delighted to have you. I'm really looking forward to this because, you know, I haven't got a clue about your perspective, and I'm really keen to get into that. So can you introduce yourself to the listeners, Isaac, and we'll get into
that. Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, I'm Isaac Etter. I'm the founder of a company called Identity. I was formerly known for my work at Etter Consulting on transracial adoption. And so I'm excited to be here. I'm excited to be on this podcast, this amazing platform where I've heard many other fabulous adoptees and child welfare professionals speak. And so I'm excited to tell my story and share more about my journey.
Brilliant. So let's get into it. Tell us about your story.
Yeah, so I was adopted by a white family when I was 2 years old. My birth mother tried to raise me for 2 years. We were homeless, and eventually led to her placing me. And so, you know, I grew up in a very white conservative family. You know, I really didn't grow up around any other people of color except for other adopted people. And so, you know, being Black was always this weird thing. I remember the first time I really noticed that I was Black and was different. I was 10 years old. I was running up the stairs coming home from a church event. And I ran into the bathroom. And as soon as I looked in the mirror, I stopped because I was shocked. And I was shocked because I saw a Black person in the mirror. I had completely forgotten that I was Black. And I remember, you know, 10 years old, that was the first time I felt, one, bad about being Black, but also was really, really in touch with the fact that I was Black. And, you know, that kind of would led me into my teen years and still battling these things. And when I was 16, it was summer I turned 16. I don't know if anybody, any of the listeners were Tumblr people, but Tumblr was really popular around, you know, 2014, 2013. And I was on Tumblr and I was searching around and I found this hashtag called Blackout Day. And it was college students who were wearing all Black in solidarity with like Black Lives Matter and police brutality. But, you know, at this point in my life, I'd never heard of these things. And so I clicked on the hashtag to be, you know, exposed to this whole different side of really the world. Learning about police brutality, racism, all these things that, you know, literally just were not in my scope of view. Nobody had conversations about these things with me. Wasn't really aware. You know, I knew about racism in terms of like Harriet Tubman, slavery, Martin Luther King Jr., but was very unaware of the current reality at that point of racism, especially in America. And so as this very naive 16-year-old, I'm being exposed to all of this. And I remember, you know, that whole summer, that whole next year of my life, there were so many questions rattling around my head. One was, you know, if the internet says this about white people, what does that mean about my parents? What does that mean about my family? That was one question. And then it was also this like really kind of nervousness about like, how do I even talk about this? You know, my family has never mentioned any of this stuff to me. So the internet is telling me one reality. My parents have raised me in a different reality. It leads for a very complicated situation, especially I think for adoptees in my situation whose parents haven't taken the time to have any of those conversations. They get stuck in the middle. And it wasn't until my 17th birthday that everything finally clicked, because I also think, just to touch on that season even more, I think there was also this question of, is this real, right? You grew up in this white family, you're adopted into this white family, all your extended family is white, your friends are white. There is a question when you learn about all this racism on the internet, there's a question of, is this a reality? Is this real? And especially for my situation. But I was 17, so I was turning, it was the night that I turned 17. Me and my friends were walking late at night, and I live in rural Pennsylvania, you know, Amish County, so lots of hills and things like that. And we were walking late at night, and we were walking down this long hill, and at the top of the hill, a cop car came and was flashing its lights around as if it was looking for somebody. And me and my friends started running. You know, we were scared that somebody made a noise complaint. Maybe they heard us. And we started running. And all of a sudden, one of my friends yells out, "It's all right. Isaac's the only one that's going to get in trouble." And I remember that moment so distinctly because it was the moment that everything clicked. Everything I had read online for the past year, everything that I was questioning, me wondering if my parents even knew that racism existed, if my friends even knew this existed, it all culminated in that one moment as my 16-year-old friend says that. I realized that everybody around me knew something that I didn't even know. And it was that I was going to be treated different and that I was different. And that's how I graduated high school. That's how I went into college. That's how I went into my adult life. And the next year, I immediately went into my freshman year of college, still confused and on this journey of understanding myself. And at college, I experienced, you know, a lot of racism. That's where I experienced my first, like, blatant racism from people who didn't know I had a white family. And so it really shook up my foundation. And then in fall of 2016, you know, the year of Donald Trump here, that was the first time I actually ever said anything about race. There was a police killing, a murder. His name was Terrence Crutcher in September of 2016. And I remember, I think I shared a post, as ironic as it is, I think I shared a post that said, "Jesus wouldn't have killed Terrence Crutcher." And I cannot even begin to tell you the backlash I received from friends, family. I think I remember even looking on Facebook and seeing that my choir teacher had commented under like the video of the shooting and saying that he deserved to die. Like, so I was like, the circle in the community that I was raised in was very much like against me, even the idea of Jesus saving Terrence Crutcher. And so this immediate backlash formed as I started to talk about race, from parents to friends to community. Even at college, I remember people asking me like, why did I care? My family was white. You know, just really not understanding, or people ask me like, when did I turn black? Just very weird instances, and my family really couldn't understand. So we were going through a lot. And it honestly just, you know, just drove me to drop out. So I just dropped out of college. I had a minivan at the time. I packed my minivan and I moved to Georgia. And that's really where I went under like kind of like my own racial identity journey. It's like, I just wanted to be around Black people and understand more about myself and get out of the mix, like get out of the community that I was raised in. And, you know, as a lot of people know, in 2016, the country really, especially the United States, and I would say, you know, I grew up in like evangelical culture, so Christian culture, a lot of evangelical culture and American culture, with the rise of Donald Trump and the rise of things like Charlottesville, and things that happened that were just really big instances of hate, it really turned the tide of the conversation about race. Like up until this point, talking about race in Christian settings was kind of like you either got bashed or you kind of got one or two people saying cool. But after 2016, after 2017, the shift really happened to where the church, at least the church at least more non-conservative. I wouldn't say that the church completely changed, but people were more open to the conversation about race. And it was very noticeable when I would come home and visit from Georgia. And so when I moved back, I think in 2018-ish, so I wasn't in Georgia terribly long, but when I moved back to a very different community. So I moved back to this community that had decided all of a sudden, after bashing me for it, that they wanted to talk about race because the narrative had switched. And so that was a very unique situation for me to walk back into. And my parents had actually done their own work too. So, you know, this is also the beginning of the healing with my parents. They had, read things like the Malcolm X biography and done their own work and started trying to understand where my pain and hurt was coming from around race. And if it wasn't for that, I don't think that we would have as beautiful as a relationship as we do now. The community that I was raised in, they honestly, not all of them, but there are some key people that I can think of in my life who I wasn't receiving the same kind of love in terms when I first started talking about race, that are now very interested in that conversation and want to talk about it. And so it was just it's a unique timing situation, I think my story is. as rough as that is, you know, if I would have waited a year later, I'm not sure the reaction would have been as deadly. But you know, you can't go back in time, and obviously it happened for a reason. That's like kind of like the gist of my story. You know, my work has since been, you know, after healing with my family, doing a lot of DEI work, doing a lot of activism work. It was around 2019. Yeah, I think it was January 2019 that I started Etter Consulting. I started Etter Consulting because a social worker that was bringing me in to do cultural trainings, she pulled me aside one time after I did a training with her. And she said, hey, you know, I know you do, you know, a bunch of other stuff, but I think maybe you should just do this. Like, you have something here. I was 19 at the time. And so I just said, you know, sure. And I just, you know, dropped everything. I spent about a month inside of a cafe learning how to build websites on Squarespace. I built a website, and that was the birth of Etter Consulting. We've gone through a lot of interesting ups and downs, but the main thing that Etter Consulting did and does still a little bit, which was work with adoption agencies. We lead, you know, cultural and bias trainings for families that are adopting, have adopted, social workers and adoption agency staffs and boards. We help especially social workers understand how to better prepare families for transracial adoption. And then we help parents understand the different challenges that their transracial adoptee will go through. And also through that training, I built in kind of a bias component, which was I wanted my trainings not only to tell my story and what their adoptee could actually go through, but I wanted it to pull out maybe unseen biases in their own lives. And so it's kind of a twofold training, which we talk about my story, but we also talk about bias and how undoing some of these biases can really help you be a better transracial adoptive parent. And then that work led into my work at Identity, which launched last week. So it's a little bit newer, but Identity's goal is to transform how we educate people around adoption. You know, there's a lot of issues within adoption in terms of ethical practice. And I think one of the ways that adoption can become more ethically sound is if we do a way better job preparing families on the front end and giving them better support while they're adopting, whether it's transracially or not. And so our goal at Identity is to really revolutionize how families are being educated, giving them the best quality, giving them interactive stuff, but also giving them a community and resources that are ongoing and constant while they're going through that journey. Yeah. So it's been a long journey to get here. That's the gist of it.
Wow. Wow, there's so much there. What I'm going to do is, you know, I'm going to link obviously to your website and to your YouTube channel so that people can find out more about the story. And the nuances and the details on this. Watching one of your YouTube videos, Isaac, I got about, I don't know, 3 minutes in, and you said something like that hit me as this is the ultimate question that I want to ask Isaac about today. You said something like, you know, that your parents came into this with the best intentions, but you realized that they weren't preparing you for a world that would treat you differently because you're black. So what is it that you'd like to share with the parents of with parents that have adopted transracially who are listening to this show, in terms of what they need to know about preparing their kids
Absolutely.
For a world that's going to treat them differently?
Absolutely. And, you know, one thing that I, you know, one thing I'd like to say preference is, like, if you haven't adopted yet, this is also a question for consideration before you transitionally adopt. A lot of people don't talk about that, but preparing Black people or people of color to go into the world is a part of the transracial adoption journey. And it's one that we don't really talk about. And so I often tell us who haven't adopted yet to think about that as well. is that if that's a process you're willing to go on, and it's okay if you're not. But if you are going on the journey, you choose to go on that journey, I'd say that there are quite a few things that you can do to prepare your adoptee to God and to the world, a world that will treat them differently than maybe they've been raised. And the first step to doing this is, I think, really building positivity around their culture and kind of their difference. We often hear difference and we think about it in a negative light, but there is a lot of beauty in difference. And I think as we grow older and we're adults, we see that. We see how much beauty there is in different cultures and different people and all these things. And I think it's an amazing thing to instill into a 0 to 5-year-old, is this really positive viewpoint of their culture, their skin tone, all the things that actually make them them. And then, you know, as you get into this kind of like elementary school time period where people start asking questions, you know, why do you look different? Why are your parents white? Why are you Black? Name calling. You've already set this basis for like, okay, well, they might say that, but remember, we think this is a positive thing. And so you've already built this foundation of like, your difference is not a otherness, it's not a negative, it's a positive. And so, you know, I always say that these things all build together. So start with the positivity, then when the questions come, you have that positive base to build off of. And you can say, hey, some people are gonna think that way, but that's not what we believe, that's not who you are. Just because they say that doesn't mean that you're bad or that your difference is bad. And then when they get into the teenage years, I think you can kind of start having these more honest conversations. I think that there's a lot of nervousness to be honest. But once kids are, you know, 10, 13, especially in this day and age, you know, the internet's going to tell them if you don't, just like the internet told me. I was a little bit older, but, you know, and the internet has changed. And so, you know, when your kids get to 10, 11, 13, you know, it's time to start having more serious conversations about what they may experience, especially if they're going out with their friends alone. You know, what do you do if the cops pull you over? What do you do, you know, if you get called the N-word? You know, all these things are conversations that need to come into play while still wrapping them in this positivity around their difference. And some of the ways that I think you can kind of continue this positiveness is by making sure that there's positive racial mirrors around. You know, adoptees like me who grew up without any people of color around them, like that sent a clear signal around what my parents thought about other people, even if they weren't saying anything. You know, I saw no other Black male adults, no other Black female adults. Without my parents saying anything, they said something. And so another way that I think you can instill that positivity is not by just saying, hey, we love your culture, we love your difference, but by actually having people in their lives that represent that. And so again, these things all build together. And yeah, I mean, I think those are kind of like, I'd say like the four things that I say are the biggest, is making sure that you're starting with positivity, building on that positivity with truth as they enter elementary school. And then again, building on that positivity, but sharing reality as they head into these teenage years. And then making sure that there are racial mirrors along the whole way. You know, don't raise them in a white world with no other people of color around them. They never see a Black person and try to praise Black culture. That's gonna send a mixed message. You know, somebody told me they love Black people, but I never saw them with a Black person. I'm gonna be very confused eventually about that. And so make sure that I think your words are also matching your actions. There are African-American fests that happen in cities. There are NAACPs, there are Be the Bridges. There are all these kinds of cultural events that you can take your adopted children to that not only reinforce this positivity around their culture, but it also shows that you're also willing to surround yourself with that culture. You're also a part of that journey with them. Not just something you're speaking to them, but something that you're in the journey with them.
Somebody said something really really insightful to me a couple of weeks ago, and they said people don't trust hypocrites.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
so we have to kind of like, words are easy. I mean, that's part of the problem with politicians, and you know, their stock in trade is words. Yeah. Of whatever persuasion they are, and words are very easy, and a lot of one of my challenges with this is that here in the UK, a lot of the politicians coming through, but they've never created anything other than words. So a lot of them are lawyers. A lot of them are lawyers, and they've earned the money through words, you know, words in court or words on contracts, and words are easy. So, but no one trusts a hypocrite. You know, it's just hot air. So what you're talking about here really is kind of rather than words, it's about action. You know, like getting involved cultural events and the communities within your city.
I think it's words that are backed by action, because you know, as adoptees, you know, I think all adoptees feel this, which is like this kind of sense of rejection and this sense of kind of confusion about who we are. Even sometimes in early days, I mean, I started feeling that way when I was like six. And so I think that it's important that the words are there too, but they have to be backed by action, because if they're not backed by action, then it's not going to be seen as real or tangible.
Yeah. What helped you on your, you talk about confusion, you talked about in your story, you said, well, you didn't know whether this was real.
Yeah.
So you said you had this naive view of the world, and I think all of us have realized when we've been naive in the past, and we have those kind of wake up and smell the coffee moments, don't we? What helped you go from confusion to clarity?
I mean, to be honest, I think just time and knowledge. So, you know, when I left and dropped out of college and moved to Georgia, I read a lot, I met a lot of people, I took a lot of time. You know, I was in a brand new space, I didn't know anybody. You know, I was living with a family friend, and they were the only people who I knew in that city. Everybody who I met in that city was new. And so I think one of it was the chance to kind of reinvent and maybe see who I really was. I think all adoptees deserve that opportunity to really go out into the world and maybe just see who they are. And so that was a cool part of the journey, was just kind of becoming myself. But it also took a lot of like time and reflection. I had to reflect on the pain that I felt from everybody in my life, the confusion as well, because it was kind of like a 0 to 100 instance. You know, I speak about race, immediate backlash. There was no kind of in-between time. And so I had to reflect and kind of deal with that. But then also surrounding myself with, you know, like a new community. You know, I met a lot of Black friends. I still have a lot of those friends who I met from living in different parts of Georgia. You know, I worked in inner city. I worked in inner city school. I worked in inner city after school program. I really got immersed in different parts of Black culture and just started living. And like, it really wasn't until I was in Georgia that I like came to terms with, I think, being a Black person. And not just like, oh, I'm a Black person, but like this idea that I'm fully a Black person and fully adopted. I think that can be a really hard place for Black transracial adoptees to get, especially who grew up like me with no, you know, Black community around them, which is where we never really feel like we're Black, you know, or Black enough. But my time in Georgia, I think it really solidified in me this idea that, you know, I was fully Black, but I was also fully my experience as a Black person. I was never going, like the white way that I was raised, that experience was never going away, but neither was the fact that I was Black, and they could both live simultaneously. And I think that's, as confusing as that sounds, like it's really hard for a lot of, I know from friends, like it's just really hard for transracial adoptees to grasp that a lot. Usually you just feel like one or the other. And I think this is why we see transracial adoptees, even if they are very progressive and they talk about race, they end up in white communities fully. It's because sometimes it's really hard to connect with both of those sides of us. And I'd say that I was lucky to have the experience at the age that I did. You know, I was really young still. I was 18 when I moved to Georgia. I mean, I think that's really what it was. It was a deep sense of clarity in the fact that like, This experience as a white person that I had growing up is never going to go away, but neither is the fact that I'm a Black person. And I'm allowed to fully be a Black person who has lived that experience, because it's not, you know, it's not changing my skin tone. You know, it's not, when I walk outside, people aren't looking at me and saying, oh, that's the Black guy who was raised by white people. Like, that's not the immediate thought. You know, I am just fully a Black person, and that's who I am. Yes, I had a unique experience where I was raised by white people, and it shaped a lot of who I am. I listen to Mumford and Sons. I have a lot of fun. I do some very stereotypically, you know, whatever they might say white things are to do sometimes. Doesn't change that I still wake up Black. It's really hard, I think, for adoptees to get that, but, you know, this is who I am. I love it. I have a ton of Black friends now, and I love my life, and I love being able to celebrate the parts of, like, being able to celebrate the fact that I'm Black without feeling like it's fake, because for a while it definitely did.
Yeah. This is a bit weird, but I've never celebrated being white.
Yeah. Yeah, I just don't think it happened. You know what I mean?
My epiphany, or one of the epiphanies over my life, was have you seen the film Roots? Have you seen Roots?
I don't think I have seen Roots.
Well, it was a mini series, actually. So it was. I've talked about it on one of the episodes of the podcast before. The British racism is very different to American racism.
Yeah.
Because we exported it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the people that came to the UK, the Black people that came to the UK, this is a mass simplification, right? And it's just my rather in the Black people that came to the UK are mainly economic migrants, not slaves, right? So we organized the slave trade.
Yeah.
The British people organized the slave trade, largely, from what I can gather. Alex Haley's miniseries Roots is based on this book called Roots, and this guy is he's the descendant of a guy called Kunta Kinte, who was Mandinka tribe. Right, Mandinka mm-hmm. tribe in the Gambia, Western Africa. It's kind of near Ghana and Senegal. We went there when I was 34. Yeah, 20 years ago we went there, and my best friend died in a car crash, and I had to come back. I had to change my flight. Right, and I was sitting at dinner crying, and this. It was my first time in Africa, and I was sitting at dinner crying, or I had cried. The waiter could tell there's something wrong, right? And he asked me what was wrong, so I told him. So my best friend has just died in a car crash. I've got to go back home, and you know, And his response was, "May his soul rest in peace." Mm-hmm. And I was deeply touched by this guy, just a waiter. I didn't know the guy, but his concern and his big heart for me, right? I told the travel company representative, who's a white woman, the following morning that we needed to come home. And her first words were, "You'll have to pay to change your flight." And at this point, I kind of realized that, you know, I grew up in a very white world, you know, that had a different view, to put it politely, you know, the developing world or whatever, you know, and here I had some kind of like crap from this white woman, and this genuine love and concern from this Black guy. Bear in mind, how many Black guys had I met at that time? Probably met less than five at the age of 34, I'd guess. So, yeah, it was one of those strange moments. But, the slave trade started from there, and then we kind of like, those Mandinka tribe and all those Senegal, Gambians and stuff like that were then, they were brought to, England, and then transported on, you know, over to the sugar plantations and the states and the Virginia and the tobacco thing. So our view of racism is very different because people, we don't have that. It's just like a whole different thing.
A whole different perspective.
It's a whole different perspective. And you know, the purpose of this show, the Thriving Adoptees podcast, is to bring different perspectives. Because different, you know, when we see things differently, when we have those different epiphany moments, when we have those aha moments, then we see things differently. And when we see things differently, we do things differently.
Absolutely.
And that's what I'm trying to get to. So to what extent do you think that feeling under attack, this backlash, to what extent do you think that was a catalyst for your clarity? And
probably a big one. I mean, you know, it's such a hard thing in the moment to look at what something is turning you into, right? And so, you know, who knows where I would have landed without that, you know what I mean? Not to say that I should glorify it at all or celebrate it at all, but it's very interesting who it turned me into. And it definitely was, I think, a catalyst, one, to the clarity, but also to the work, right? You know, I was already getting into like racial, you know, issues, doing that kind of work, studying those kinds of things, but it pushed me even further into it, where I realized, okay, yes, I do have to do something here. And then it pushed me even further to saying, okay, well, I think I need to specifically do it inside of adoption. And so I think it's a huge catalyst. And, you know, as painful as it was, and it was one of the most painful and traumatic times of my life, it definitely did springboard me into a whole different journey. One that I, you know, 10 years ago, I couldn't have even guessed that I would be speaking about race inside of adoption. I wouldn't even have the framework. And so as much as it is painful, it's very interesting, you know, it was a catalyst to the clarity, and it kept pushing me until I think it landed me where it wanted me, which was inside of adoption, talking about it as well.
Yeah. So we have a couple of sayings that I've heard recently that say the same things, really, is that our mess becomes our message.
Yep. Absolutely.
Our poop becomes our manure.
Yeah.
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 What we go through helps us grow. I probably had those the wrong way around. So what we go through, the poop, helps us grow the manure. And then our mess, the stuff that we went through, becomes our message.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So have you got any stories of the change that you've seen in others on this, adoptive parents? Any like big aha adoptive moments from adoptive parents of transracial adopted kids that might catalyze change in?
Yeah. Well, I think that there's a ton of little changes, and maybe they're not little, maybe they're not little to the parents, but from the first time I started speaking, I noticed that there was a lot of just curiosity. You know, one time I was doing a talk, and a very emotional mother, you know, she said, "Hey, we live on a farm. We're very scared that our Black child isn't going to feel Black if he grows up on a farm." You know, and, you know, just talking through her about like, you know, that's not, a farm isn't a make or break for a Black person. You know what I mean? There's other things you can do, but like stuff like that happens very regularly. And it seems to be, I mean, I don't think it's small moments, but questions like that stir up inside of adoptive parents all the time. You know, another one was like, do do-rags mean gang signs, right? You know, if you wear a do-rag, is that a gang thing, right? Well, do-rags help you get waves, so no. But like, there's these mini things that happen constantly that I think are significant, and they change perspectives really heavily. But then there's kind of, I think, the more emotional side of it, where, you know, I have had adoptive parents who have kind of, you know, broken out in the middle of the Q&A section talking about, you know, having foster children who were of different races who decided to leave their home because they didn't feel culturally safe. And talking with parents about that has been a huge emotional thing. There's also just been, I think there's been deep moments of vulnerability inside of my talks, which I think are hard to come by. It's hard to go to a talk and hear deep moments of vulnerability, but I don't think I've ever done, especially a live talk, in which somebody didn't ask a very vulnerable question: should I leave my church because there's no Black people? And getting very emotional while talking about the pain of bringing this Black child into their home that is not surrounded at all by anybody who looks like them, right? Same with children that want to leave. I don't know that I have a pinpoint of one specific story. I think that they're all kind of important. But I'd say it's just questions like that. You know, a lot of my talks are meant to be moments where you can ask hard questions like that. And I would say that without a doubt, every talk that I do, somebody asks a question along these lines. Will my child feel so-and-so if I raise him here? My family doesn't want to talk about race. How should I approach talking to my grandparents and my parents about race? You know, these are the moments that my talks are filled with. And so I don't know if I have one specific story, but I'd say that, yeah, go ahead.
Is there a thread there? So what I get from that is it is people very caught up with very specific issues.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so on one level, on one hand, there's this, you know, identity is a big, deep, profound subject. Okay.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Transracial, it's a big thing. It's a big thing, but people are, you know, they're and very, as you say, very emotional about it, and yet, they are reducing it to something that is very small, that a very small thing. Well, right. It's not a very small thing, but a lot smaller, you know, than the choice of the church or the
yeah.
So. Are they, my take on it is, and I do this too, right, is that I lose perspective. Yes. I lose perspective and I'm not seeing the forest
or
the trees.
And
so we're all hung up on the little bits like, so for me, how many listeners have I had? How many downloads have I had? I've got this big mission to help adoptees thrive, right? But then I'm hung up with the detail of, but just before I came on, I'm looking at the metrics and I'm looking, are we still, what does that curve look like? What does the download curve look like? Why can't I get the download curve to look like I want to get it? Look like? Why haven't I even got the data to give me? So we kind of, I'm going to town on this a little bit because I'm bringing it to a point, but I'm making it about me rather than about dissing the listeners or you for that matter. I'm saying, watch out, guys. If you're taking this big issue, this transracial adoption and identity issue, and you're trying to reduce it to one thing and seeing that as the silver bullet that's going to solve this, then you're looking in the wrong place. You've lost the wood for the trees. Look at the wood and I don't know if can you add to that?
I can't, here's the thing. I think it kind of circles back to what we're doing at Identity Now, to be honest, is that all these like little things that I've seen in my talks, just like that, just like these questions, the way parents are approaching things, the way people are being educated about adoption, about identity development, it's stuck on these nuances, stuck on these little questions, you know, raising them here, a church there. I think you're totally right. And one of the reasons that I decided to shift directions in how I do this work is because those are little questions that we can, you know, one of the reasons we built this learning community for adoptive and foster parents was because that's a space for them to have that conversation. That's a space for those kinds of questions. But when we're doing these bigger trainings, when we're learning especially before we've adopted, there needs to be so much work done in terms of the trauma and the identity development challenges, right? When we think about adoption and we talk about adoption, even before they've been adopted, especially, we're not talking about the level of trauma or the level identity development issues that adoptees are going to have, regardless, it happens across the board. And so for me, I think you're totally on point because this is the issue that we're trying to solve in adoptive parents, which is that adoptive parents are usually brought into adoption and foster care naively with small questions, small frameworks. And that's not to be offensive. I feel like adoption has been designed that way because it keeps the flow of foster parents and adoptive parents coming in. But if we did a better job of training parents to think way more deeply about the identity development of their child outside of these small factors, the trauma that's also informing some of these issues, and then all the other nuances of adoption. And then these small questions can be filtered through a community, very similar to IAS, or through a social worker, or through a different platform. I think we just see a very big change in the trajectory of adoptees, right? If you talk to other transracial adoptees, 9 out of 10 of them are gonna have very similar stories that I do. You know what I mean? I often don't think that my story is anything superbly special because every time I talk to a transracial adoptee, they say the same things. Families weren't prepared, families never talked about race, got into adulthood, hit them in the face, right? And so the issue that we have in adoption that you just touched on is that too much focus on these small details, not enough foundational training, not enough foundational knowledge, not enough real support along these lines. And I think if we change that, we change the outcomes of adoptees. Yeah. And so I do agree with what you're saying. And it does circle back to the bigger work that I think we're doing now, which is let's change that. Let's change how people are being educated. Let's change the little bit small-mindedness of the questions and turn this into a bigger and broader conversation.
I think, because you know, you mentioned the trauma word a couple of times there, and I just flipped. I wanted to get into the empowerment bit after the inspiring bit of the story. You know, the fact I didn't go anywhere near that, but you know, like the fact I wanted to ask you actually, you know, like homeless. Do you remember being homeless?
I don't. I mean, I was 0 to 2.
Yeah, I know, but I don't know. I wanted to ask you that question, but
It's hard, you know, it's a hard part of the story. And I think it's a whole nother conversation in adoption because we could literally be here for hours talking about all the different things inside of here. But there is a question about, you know, if my mother went homeless trying to raise me for 2 years, you know, and placing was her best option. We have issues in terms of mother support. We have issues in terms of single and just low-income family support. And my adoption story in that regard is also not unique because that happens especially to Black families constantly. Too poor, their kids end up in the system. And so it's a whole nother issue. But no, I don't remember it, but it is, you know, it's a significant.
Okay. Just want to circle back to something else that you're saying in terms of like why we don't do this stuff, why we, like me, I fall for this. I miss the forest for the trees all the time. I'm not saying I'm just as guilty. I'm just as guilty as making that mistake as anybody else. And this sort of preparation thing, I think it seems to be part of human nature that we ain't great at any sort of preparation. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
We leave stuff until it's bad. So, like, you know, I can think of something, you know, just last week with my broadband. I had some problem with my broadband. And anyway, I've got a better one than that. I've I we got a big front door, right? Big wooden front door, oak. It's heavy, and the key's been jamming in it. But instead of getting it fixed, instead of getting the locksmith to come out and have a look at it, I waited till it was broken, and then it snapped. The lock broke on Saturday morning, so I had to get my neighbours. I had to get my neighbour around with his ladder. And I had to climb in through my top window in the bedroom to get in. Then I had to call the locksmith. And it's like 250 quid to fix this, like 300 and something odd dollars to get this fixed. But that was only because I didn't get it fixed before. He spent 2 hours trying to actually tease the door open before he could do any of the work. And I could have done that before, you know, I could, but I left it too late. It's something to do with human nature. Yeah. And the reason I'm going on about it is like, Don't wait with this stuff.
Absolutely.
Don't wait with this stuff. Don't focus in on this little piece. Get in touch with Isaac, and take some proactive action. Absolutely. And as I'm saying that, I want to say something quite important on this is the fact that if you've got to this point in the podcast and you're still listening, you're already being a proactive parent. You're already doing something. And I've done a lot of work with non-adoptive parents, and they're not as proactive as adoptive parents are. Adoptive parents are aware that there could be issues further down the line. So you're actually in a better place than most people. Yeah. Adoptive parents listening, you seem to me to actually be keener, more proactive. So I want to congratulate you and give you a clap on the back, a virtual clap on the back for having listened to this podcast and for in advance of taking the next step and getting watch Isaac's videos, get in touch with him on his website. I'm going to put a link, put links in the show notes to the website, and let's be proactive about this stuff.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we can. And people are. And I think you're right. Adoptive parents are more proactive. And I think that there's a continuation that we're going to see. I think the more that, especially as more as like us adoptees are building platforms and building resources, I think the more positiveness we're going to see. I'm a firm believer that adoptees need to lead the way in how adoption change is going to happen. And, you know, I think that podcasts like this, work like mine, work like several other adoptees are doing out there, all super important and all ways that parents can be proactive and support. And I'm really excited when I see adoptive parents participating and being a part of the resources that adoptees build.
Okay, last question.
Yeah,
I've just started doing this recently on the podcast. Yeah. What do you want to call this episode of the podcast?
Oh man, that's a great question. Man, what do I want to call this episode? I'm trying to think about if there's any significant phrase that has come out. Maybe like doing the work. Doing the work would be kind of cool. What was the phrase that you just used when you were talking about adoptive parents?
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
The proactivity. I was thinking
proactive.
Sorry?
You said proactive.
Yeah.
How to be proactive or being proactive. Yeah. I think something along those lines would be really cool.
Something like raising transracial adoptees, a proactive approach. Is that too long-winded?
Yeah. I like that. I think that's cool. Transracial adoption, a proactive approach.
Oh, right, yeah.
That's even a little bit slimmer.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, something around those, yeah. There's something, yeah. I think there's one between there, but I will give that some thought.
Yeah. Wow.
Brilliant, my friend.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for coming on, and thank you everybody for listening, and we'll speak to you again very soon.
Absolutely. Thank you.